Howdy, everyone. Welcome back to Warp Celluloid. I'm your host, Jack Rourke, with my co-host,
Chandler Williams. Thank you, Jack.
So, a little bit of context before we go into the nitty-gritty of today's episode. We were originally going to do Waking Life this week. We still intend to do it later, but some scheduling things came up, and we needed to shuffle things around a little bit to make everything work. But for now, we're going back to another one of my picks from the proverbial 10. This one, another 70s genre exercise that feels very out of the box, but one very near and dear to my heart. And Chandler, you have kept really quiet in the lead up to this, and that has me all the more hyped to get into this. So without further ado, today's film, Nicholas Roeg's The Man Who Fell to Earth.
What do you do? For a living, I mean.
Oh, just visiting.
Where exactly did he come from?
Where I come from, there's a terrible drought.
What do you want to go back to a desert for?
Do you trust me, Dr. Price?
I think so.
I know people think me unnecessarily secretive.
If I were you, I'd be secretive.
This is my first time watching it, and honestly, like, about not even halfway through, the thought crossed my mind, like, this is the most Jack movie I think I've ever seen, like, the most right up Jack's alley, just the most you, and I can see why you love this film, and I think that's awesome. It just fit your style and, like, the work that I've seen you do, how much this has impacted and inspired you, and just like how it connects with your taste in just the most specific way. That was very satisfying to see, and I totally see why you love this movie.
Well, first off, thank you, but I think honestly all the credit here is Roeg's, and of course Bowie's, who, oh boy, have we talked about a movie with Bowie on the show yet? Because I feel like he's come up once or twice, but never in any specific roles.
Yeah, I don't think so. I know you're a big Bowie fan, and I like his music a lot. I liked it a lot in high school, but I have differing views about like him as an actor, and but I don't think we've discussed
him. I can't lie and say every role he took was magnificent, because I think it's undeniable that the guy has a presence on screen, and it's understandable why he got cast. And side note, this movie is probably the most likely reason he got cast in The Prestige, just putting that out there. I do think that the connection to me is a very far-running thing. I saw Guardians of the Galaxy at 14, and that was the first real, like, hey, this David Bowie guy's kind of cool, I should check this out. Then I went through my Ziggy Stardust phase in my first year of high school, and after that I was basically a bona fide super fan ever since. I mean, musically, the guy is just ahead of the curve on so many things, and he listened to so much. He is truly a once-in-a-generation artist that I think is worth respecting in every aspect, and I'm not sure if we'd ever cover this in future because documentaries are kind of a crapshoot with is it weird enough for this sort of thing, but man, seeing this in Moon Age this again, I should preface it's because I've had a odd history going into this. I saw it for my 18th birthday a few years ago, 5 years ago, I think now. It stuck with me, but not in a way that, and it's weird, I had a similar experience with Trainspotting around the same time, and where it hit me just enough to be like, okay, I get why this is iconic, but the immediate classic nature of it, it took a while to really sink root in my brain. Right, I sit with it for a couple years, I'm like, hey, I should probably go back to that. There's things I'm thinking about and ideas that would float around, and then I want to go back to it again, and then again, and right, and then I start to realize, holy fuck, I love this movie. Right, a movie, and it's just worked its way in subconsciously, and I think that's fitting, especially considering who's behind the camera. I've been meaning to ask for a long time, what is your experience with Nick Roeg, and what have you heard, like, what's your general impression going off this and just the broader oeuvre?
I mean, honestly, I have just heard of him from Don't Look Now, which I've heard is fantastic, which I've also not seen, but yeah, I mean, I knew he did this and that, and I was excited to watch either of them, and I'm glad we chose this. Although I don't know, I feel like a lot of the creative decisions made didn't really stick with me, or didn't really land with me, so to say. I can't help but respect them, and I feel like that's how I feel about this movie as a whole. This was my first time watching it, and I didn't love it. You know, I didn't love it how you say you do, Jack, and have that relationship with it, which I think is awesome. But it didn't really connect with me in a way that I don't know that I can really put words to, other than there's a lot there. There's a lot going on. A lot of intentional decisions at play that I think are pretty of its time. I don't want to use the word dated, but the aesthetic is very strong, very enhanced.
It's an understandable reaction. And I mean, at a certain point as a film fan, you have to make peace with the fact that not everyone is going to love everything. That's why you got to, over time, you start to pick up things about people and you try to tailor your recommendations. I mean, but with that in mind, I don't think this should turn you off from Roeg if you're not a big fan of this, because it's merely just an introductory hint of what he goes for. Because I think part of the reason that I find him so special as a filmmaker is, look, we hear the term movies or dreams and talk of fantasy land and whatever in regards to movies very frequently. It's one of the most obvious cliche comparisons you can make, but Roeg's films function fundamentally like dreams and subconscious things. You Look Like Don't Look Now, the non-linear editing and just juxtaposing things in time. I think it captures something honest about how people experience things, and the general thing is, let's see how he does with a standard, pretty narrow story, or a very clear beginning, middle, and end, and very clear protagonist. Like, probably the most accessible thing he made outside of... He made Roald Dahl's The Witches back in the 90s, but otherwise, I'd say this is the one that probably gels best with audiences.
No, in regards to the dreamlike aesthetic, that makes me think of some of the crossfades and some of the juxtapositions in the nonlinear editing, just like flashes of the past or of his home planet. And a lot of those really worked. I thought most of them were very compelling and successful. But when it didn't work, for me, it just felt kind of clunky.
Understandable. I think there's a bit... Let me guess. There's a bit in the opening where we first introduced a Riptorn, and then that whole segment goes on. I imagine that could be off-putting for people. It was to me on my first watch. I was like, oh, this is going there. Okay, then.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. There's a surprising amount of sex in this movie that I wasn't expecting. And the sex scenes were very long in a fascinating way, stylistically. And creatively. Like I said, this is a Jack movie just all around. Kidding.
Okay, maybe that one was a little bit more of a back and a compliment.
No, I'm just kidding.
I know. No, you're kidding.
Yeah.
Hey, but I'm like, okay, then I forgot I should have expected this. But if I may focus on the subconscious thing, you're going to... I don't think Roeg is thought of as a traditionally erotic filmmaker, not in the way guys like Almodovar or Ken Russell... But I think it connects to his broader interest in the inner machinations of people, well, and how those juxtapose onto the world around them, which this movie, I think, makes the most blatant out of his work. It's definitely a centerpiece of Don't Look Now, and there's hints of it in Walkabout, which, if there's one movie in this filmography that I'm going to recommend to you, Chandler, it's Walkabout.
Gotcha.
That's the one that I think it's going to click with you. The nature of photography in that movie, equally as stunning as anything in The Tree of Life.
Nice.
I'm just going to put that out there now and call me hyperbolic, but wait till you see the thing for yourself. Just the lens work in that movie and the colors and the framing, it is truly awe-inspiring.
Yeah, I will check it out. I will watch it. I was telling you before I started recording or while we were off the air that the theater that I work at showed Don't Look Now, and that was very popular. And it seemed like, you know, as I was watching people leave the theater, it had a, you know, very strong impact on them. So that's always really inspiring to see. And I will definitely check more of his stuff out.
That ending is just one of those endings that just completely, I don't want to call it a rug pull because that makes it sound cheap, but it completely recontextualizes everything you'd seen in a way that feels like a twist or in a way that forms twists as we now understand them. Not inventing them, obviously, but inventing a new way of communicating to them that you could argue has its ups and downs, but I think this still packs a punch. And I do think I'd say the same for this. And yeah, there's a lot of it at some of his time, I think sometimes things need to be dated to a specific time and place in order to be really seen as milestones. And when I see this, I think of it as a relatively revolutionary, forward-thinking film, stylistic, mainly and more subconscious, relying more on the subconscious angle of science fiction. And like I see stuff like Soderbergh's Solaris and High Life stemming out from things like this. I know a bunch of people. This is again one of those favorite filmmaker, favorite movie things. I know a bunch of people we admired like this film, including one of the things I noticed was comic book artist Mike Allred. Huge fan of this movie. Huge.
Nice.
He's drawn a lot of Bowie stuff. It makes complete sense.
Yeah, and I don't hate on things. I mean, I don't hate this movie whatsoever, but I think, Jack, you initially told me about the term of its time, which I think is so much more helpful and productive and critically enhancing than just to throw around the word dated. Because this movie is very grounded in the time that it was made and in a very distinct way, like not just the costumes and the kind of prog rock score, which I know you loved.
But I'm gonna have notes about that.
Yeah, I'm sure. I thought so. I don't know, but also just like the very Bowie era of pop culture. You know, this felt very grounded in that too. Like it felt like it was banking.
There's
on,
a glam to it.
There is a glam to it. I feel like it was banking on his stardom and him as an icon in a way that I thought was cool and that worked and gave him, you know, this air of mystique to his character.
This is the exact kind of movie, and you know, I'm just gonna bounce off of this since we're on the subject, where when I talk about finding rock stars being cast in movies interesting, this is exactly what I'm talking about. Knowing how a person registers in front of a set of human eyes, multiple sets of human eyes for that matter, you're in thinking clearly about it, trying to work them in, integrate them naturally. Don't just give them a vehicle that can be put out in theaters or make a killing on opening weekend and fade into the old memory hole once all is said and done. I like something that's a little more cunning with its casting. I mean, you can't argue that him playing an alien is just one of those, oh, duh, why didn't we think of this sooner things. But I think I'm glad the gig ultimately went to Roeg, especially considering how the casting front was also just as much of a toss-up. Bowie was his top choice from the beginning, but other names that were floated around, one of which is decried by Refn, but it was Peter O'Toole, who Roeg denies, but everyone else says, like, no, you were gunning for him this whole time. The other being novelist Michael Crichton. Purely by the fact that he was over 6.5 feet tall, which fits the description in the Walter Tevis novel, which we will also get to soon. And it's funny that we're going to talk about Bowie in regards to the music from the film, considering how none of it is his contributions. This is not entirely an accident, as for those who are already in the know, two images from this movie are used for his album covers. The first being a shot from inside the spaceship for Station to Station, cropped black and white. White, tasteful white, or in white border, or in red text, the one we all know and love. The second being Low, which is where the Berlin stuff begins. It's a side portrait of him in the full Newton outfit, painted, lovely, good use of negative space. I think it's worth harping on the visual angle there, because this is a movie Bowie clearly took seriously and committed to as much as he could. But there's interesting details I found about him preparing for the role. I don't want to go for the hyperbole and say this is like Christian Bale and the Machinist, but it was certainly on my mind reading some of the things he'd do to get ready the look down that Roeg wanted for this.
Like what? What did he do?
Well, first off, it's worth mentioning that he barely remembers any filming of this movie because of, the Thin White Duke era, the Thin White for a reason. A little bit of the old...
Yeah.
And yeah, right. He basically spaced out for a period of time, and you see that alienation on screen in a way that I think works, but that's not the core to the performance, I reckon. The other thing I'd mention is he kept a very small diet, maintained a very thin physique. And for this, he basically pencil thin, stick bug, like a truly gangly, off-putting, but also strangely alluring presence. This is why I don't feel comfortable writing off all of method acting. I just hate a lot of the mythology around it, because yes, a lot of it can be used to justify asshole behavior, but other times it can be just at a level of commitment to a thing without making a huge show of it, which I think is the case with this.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think it's commendable whenever the final product is successful and done right, and you know they're not being an asshole in the process.
When it's not Jared Leto, I'm fine with it.
Yeah. I don't know. Whenever I think of Bowie in the traditional sense, or just the idea of Bowie, or listen to some of his music, this is how I see him. Yeah, like you said, the Thin White Duke era. But, yeah, I mean, I just from watching this, I feel like it's very evident that he was having a great time, even though when, like, his character's obviously not...
the most likable.
Yeah, not the most likable, or the, you know, not... having a great time, but you can just feel him having a great time and like him just soaking all of this up, you know, enjoying like the fish out of water kind of alienation surrounding his character. But I don't know, he just got this swagger to him that's made me think of Mick Jagger in a way, but a different aesthetic.
Not entirely an accident, because yeah. To circle back around to Roeg, he did do a movie with Mick Jagger, Performance. Also worth a look. That one might take a viewing or two to really let you sink in. It didn't click with me the first time. Second time, when I was willing to hear it out more, man, that's something else.
Cool.
But circling back to Bowie, I think it's kismet that this lands right in between Station to Station and Low, especially considering Low is supposed to be the score for this movie. The second half of the album, I need to stress. That's the portion with Warshawa and all the instrumental. It's really, and it's interesting to me because the first half of it, yeah, and it sounds like a lot like what Eno would produce with like Talking Heads and other bands in future, or where it's still recognizably pop music with hooks and interesting instrumental digressions, but it's still largely structured in a conventionally what we think of as songs. The second half is pure soundscape, Abe. It's allowing you to really sink back and lose yourself in a space, and I get why Roeg ultimately turned down the material he did, and to my knowledge, that pretty much everyone agreed that things worked out for the best, this ending up on Low and the score being what happened here. I really do find it interesting when artists try to really try and make something holistic and all-encompassing without getting too unwieldy about it, and integrating aspects of their work into other people's work and vice versa. It represents the free flow of ideas in a way that I find compelling.
Absolutely, and the promotion of collaboration. Which I always think is cool and admirable.
And speaking of which, this soundtrack, it's interesting you call it a score, because I'm really unsure as to how much of this was library stock and how much of this was licensed. Some of which I can kind of get. Yes, and while we're on that note, I want to say, among our things, I really love the use of Holst the Planets, when he's meeting Farnsworth, the accountant, patent lawyer, rather.
Yeah.
The way Irene just does with that slow push in on Bowie with those anamorphic flares. I love the way that this movie just makes time and space elastic in a way. A lot of that is shooting very long lenses with a lot of good light sources that can appear around the frame. It's a really... I don't want to say this is an overwhelming movie, but I will say there is a lot going on in subtle, minute doses depending on where you're looking. It's consistently engaging in a way that I find few films to really achieve on a sensory level. And that, I think, is the core of why it resonates with me personally, is that there is something quietly overwhelming and sad about this film at the core of it. Because, at its root, this is a story of hubris. Of failure. Of something a lot more intangible to deal with for us to deal with. Imagine it's someone with this much power and this much distance overhang who goes as far as any person could hope to achieve in life and ultimately fails. and the core of that and the rest into that, it leaves a sting to it at the end that really moves me.
I'm glad it does. I need to sit with it for a minute, and I'd love to revisit it soon. Yeah, I feel like he was doomed to fail from the beginning. I feel like he knew he wasn't going to be successful or wasn't going to make it back. But again, that's just my first impression of it. And it's kind of a sad story, honestly. No one in the film is really happy. No one is in a really good position. And if they are not, it's not for long.
Yeah, right. They don't really get the chance to really take it in, and things start to warp and pervert around them. It's really, yeah, it leads to the sinking feeling in a way that I wouldn't say is nihilistic, again, in any regard, but there is a tragedy at the core of this movie of someone wanting to do something great and then just having it collapse like sand through their fingers.
Yeah, I wouldn't say nihilistic, more so just, I don't know, just like a heavy melancholy, a heavy kind of angst.
And if I may go back to the score, since Bowie's contributions were rejected and reused later in a different context, he reached out to musical director John Phillips, and yes, that is what he's credited as, which, not used to seeing that around that often, huh? But my point is, it's not like it's exactly that far of a shift, considering Phillips had a background in the Mamas and the Papas. He did have a pretty good access to a music library, mixed it in with some of his own compositions and a lot of needle drops in there, I think all of which are in effect fairly effective to one degree or another, right, and used in a pretty good variety of ways, both as centerpiece to the scene and others for background texture. Right, but the centerpieces to the scenes really leave a lasting impression.
Absolutely.
The whole Sneal drop I mentioned earlier, especially, there's a cue in this album called Jazz 2 that has been in my on repeat for, like, I want to say 8 months now.
Nice.
It's amazing just what this synthesis of imagery and sound, or sound and vision, funny enough, another low reference, it tunes into something that I don't think a more literal-minded adaptation of this book would be able to accomplish, expressing the unexpressible feelings underneath.
Yeah, and the sparse use of synth, I think, is fantastic in this, especially on those wide shots of the landscape. That feels just like epitome 70s sci-fi and just works so well, and I love it so much. And when you're referring to more of the centerpiece compositions, it made me think of a film that I would love to cover in the near future, which we did talk about, that being On the Silver Globe, which does some really interesting and unique and very bold use of I haven't done the research, but just prog rock in very strange spots that works but changes the tone in such a drastic but like cool way that I feel is very successful. And it definitely crossed my mind a few times during this film.
That episode's still scheduled a few months out, which it's just the way things are. But man, if there is a movie that I am excited to cover that's still completely unknown to me, it's got to be something like this. Sci-fi movies with extensively interesting production stories, yeah, those are basically an instant, we'll cover that. That, such is the case with this, too.
Absolutely. And I feel like they have similar enough, I wouldn't say aesthetics, but styles in the most broad and gestalt way of, 70s, 80s, sci-fi, that has a lot to say, for sure. Pretty dense works. But yeah, we'll get to that film on that episode, which I'm excited to do so as well whenever we do. But yeah, I mean, this made me want to listen to David Bowie. Maybe want to, I don't know, just like live in that style of his and revel in what an awesome guy he was, you know?
I also want to highlight that stylistic disconnect that this movie does with the cross Randy Cutting, and I want to say, now having heard the 4K, that the sound mix on this thing is terrific. Randy, that's the kind of thing where I'm like, okay, I can argue against Randy, this being specifically dated in a way of, like, this is a trend, something that's going to spark a lot of other movements and ideas further on, because it really gives you a good space. We're in a space, level of distance, recording the variety of sounds you hear in the whole thing. And it's really well thought out and encompassing and involving and engrossing all the lovely words imaginable. I cannot praise the technical side of this movie enough. But I focus on this so intently because, if it hasn't been mentioned yet, the Tevis novel that this is based on, you'd know him as the author of The Queen's Gambit. Gambit and The Hustler, among other things. Things aside from this, it's a very simple read. It's a very simple point told very, not lacking in eloquence, of course, but it is not terribly didactic. It gets to the point A to B. You can knock out the reading in a weekend. I think all of that, adding texture to it and expanding it, because again, weekend read. This movie runs slightly over 2 hours. There is a lot that Roeg and Bowie bring to this. I think this is an interesting example of something resonating with an artist, them realizing that on screen and bringing out something completely interesting and that feels new when you actually have it play out.
Yeah, and we were talking before we started recording a little bit about just the idea of adaptations in general, and particularly the adaptations that are arguably better than the source material. And I have not read this book, but I would like to now. And that makes total sense.
It's a good read. I'd recommend it.
Cool. Yeah, I will read it maybe sometime this summer. But it very much does bring to life, you know, a vibrant synthesis of sound and image. I mean, like all films. But there's something almost transient about this to where, I mean, as I was saying before, some of those wide exterior, just like scoping landscape shots with the dreamy synth.
The widest of scope photography.
Yeah, it just brings up this aesthetic and this feeling of otherworldliness that I know you couldn't achieve from words on a page. And I think that's so brilliant and inspiring, honestly, as well. And it makes me want to make movies.
I want to expand upon that because this is where that personal connection comes in. For those who don't know, I am on the autism spectrum, and it's been a part of my life that I've had various feelings about at various times, one point or another. I've always found it a difficult thing to grapple with an identity. And yes, I not going to overstate my experience, but there is an alienation you feel that there, and a way of perceiving the world that makes you feel like you're crazy sometimes. It feels like everything happens at once, things just blur together, and the way Roeg translates that mindset, it really resonates with me, because I'm like, oh my god, someone gets how this feels. And it's worth noting that both Roeg and Tevis were creating the story from places of loneliness and displacement and having to refamiliarize with yourself in new settings.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Jack. I can see how that would be, inspiring and validating to see that synthesis on screen. And see what you mean, man.
I like to think that there are really only two schools of looking at stories, and that's logical truth and emotional truth. And more often than not, I'm far more interested in emotional truth, which is what this is aiming at. Not so how something is, although that is important. I don't want to say one is inherently better than the other. I feel like sometimes people lean towards the former too much, to where it loses sight of what's... It misses the forest for the trees. It gets too didactic. This goes for something a lot more esoteric. And I don't want to say it feels like heart-wrenching or manipulative. And I mean manipulative in the negative way, not in the inherent manipulation of film emotions. It just resonates. It's an experiential thing to me. It's the way it moves and sounds and how it all coalesces in service of a broader idea. If a film can successfully get you in a headspace, I think it's worth talking about.
Absolutely.
A unique one. One that is very often occurring in strange points in your life, transitionary periods. But someone needs to express the unexpressible, lean into the subconscious, the stuff that we can't easily put into boxes. Or in boxes, even if this is arguably a very commercial way of doing it. I mean, this was still a soundtrack put out by RC. Hey, and side note, speaking of the commercial side of this movie, the story about the Paramount executives who funded this thing and then pretty much immediately kicked it to the curb was like, why the fuck did you make this so weird?
Yeah,
exact wording, obviously, but
I could see how someone could, you know, have that response to this. Going off of your previous point of having the two schools of thought in regards to film, I would add to the latter, like, more of an expression of ideas, whether emotional or not, I'd say like on a logical space, which I feel is where Kubrick lives and is successful. And I feel like this does that too, you know. It rather than sticking to an explicit narrative story, it's more about a conveying of ideas and emotional states. And I think it's far more successful at that, and does so very successfully, because you're just watching him, you know, kind of getting pushed around and pushing himself around and letting himself get trampled on. And, it's very evocative of, an emotion that I can't really describe at the moment.
I have a word for it. Alienation.
Alienation. That's a great word.
Rip shot.
Yeah.
I'm only half saying that in jest, to be honest, because yes, we've seen a lot of fish out of water movies and use that, but how many of them actually like hit the root of something beyond the base premise? And it's like, how many of those use those to extrapolate into broader ideas? Because there is also a sly commentary of someone who is technically an immigrant coming to America and getting corrupted by all of the awful things about American media and culture.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely there. And there's one line by the, I can't think of her name, but the lead female role.
Candy Clark.
Yes, where she's like, you're an alien. And I don't know, there's a little like a switch that happens where, you know, we think she means alien, but she's referring to like his visa expiring, and which is, you know, comes off as a joke, but there's something going on there and something to be said and explored for sure.
I hate to quote the meme, but does she know? this is one of those, should I cut this? I should cut this. And no, then at the last minute, while I'm actually looking at the audition tab, and I'm just thinking, Nah,
just leave it. That's pretty funny. I don't think I'm familiar with that. I haven't been on my meme game in a while.
It's a YouTube thumbnail about like theories regarding the Batman. There's really not much else to explain beyond that.
Okay.
It's so asinine, but it makes me laugh.
Nice. That's what it's all about.
It's funny that Freddy Got Fingered came up a couple weeks ago, considering right how the main thing I love about that movie is the Rip Torn performance. And yeah. I think it's worth highlighting because I think Freddy Got Fingered and the Men in Black movies are pretty much how a lot of our generation know Rip Torn. Or if you're a little bit older than us, maybe the Larry Sanders Show.
I recently watched Freddy Got Fingered when it came out on the channel for the first time. And seeing this, I was like, oh, that's him. So I don't know. I feel like
in a completely different context and tone.
I feel like he would take that. I don't know how he would take it. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I feel like I don't know. I doubt that he would want to be known as the Freddy Got Fingered dad. Great movie. Masterpiece.
If you look back further in his career, you see a lot more range and you see a lot more expressions of the same anger there in a less cartoonish angle, well, I'd say. But here, it's something a little more subdued. It's a more recognizably kind of scummy. And in a weird way, by the time you reach the end, he's arguably the saddest character in the entire movie. Guy who is a leech. Doesn't contribute anything, really. Just hangs around. I mean, he's a college professor who sleeps with his own students. That could tell you most of what you need to know going in. But the way he just cynically climbs up the ladder at World Enterprises, the corporation Newton makes throughout the film, there's a calculatingness to it, and only too late does he realize, wait a minute, am I bringing the end to something that really shouldn't be interfered with? There's a guilt hanging over the broader performance that I find really that's what I mean when I talk about expanding from the book, because that I roughly have the same takeaway after reading that, but this enhances it and communicates in a way that really does make it sing.
Yeah, especially that ending, like one of the final scenes, whenever they go to the liquor store on like Christmas or near Christmas, there's something just so just sad about it. And I don't know, but contrasting with that, but leading up to the final scene itself, whenever he meets David Bowie's character, it doesn't say explicitly where they are, I don't think, but somewhere tropical. Yeah, there's just that sadness and regret in the air.
What makes these stories work at their best is the connection to something broader, human beyond a generalized experience. The thing that actually makes you connect to it and identifiable feelings and situations associated with that kind of schema. But going off of Rip Torn, aside from him, this movie has a really solid supporting cast with a lot of eclectic casting choices. Screenwriter Buck Henry shows up as Farnsworth, and man, it's funny every time that movie shoots him. Right, this movie and others shoot him with glasses. It makes his eyes look gigantic.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be funny.
And he's a very interesting guy, and I was listening to the Criterion commentary track now that they have it streaming again. We're into it. By the way, I was looking around in a record store trying to buy a title for a future episode, and I found in a case the Criterion disc for this movie. If you want an idea just how out of print this thing is, $145.
Wow.
Yeah, good luck getting that one right anytime soon. We haven't even summed up what this movie's about yet, have we? We're like, what, 40 minutes into recording?
I feel like it's pretty explanatory now. I mean, I always assume, like, people aren't going to listen if they haven't seen the movie, but yeah, I feel like we've touched on it enough, but go for it.
It's all right. I love a title that can just tell you everything a movie's about in like a handful of words.
Exactly.
See, also Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia. Right, 7 words, you instantly get what that thing is. You're sold, you're in for the ride. We might cover that one in future, by the way. I've been dying to do a Sam Peckinpah episode forever.
Nice.
For all the talk of this being a relic of 70s sci-fi, I also look at a lot of other things in the same thing. I see differences, some substantial, some minor, in that, yes, there's a lot of stuff all the time, the fashion, the music, the camera techniques, and the visual effects, which I still think largely hold up in a very lo-fi, alienating, quiet kind of way. But there's a tone here that really, it's weird seeing on a studio level, even now, when this thing eventually kind of became the operating mode for well-respected, high-budget sci-fi. The further back you go, you realize that all these films kind of descend in a line, even if that line gets kind of murky, depending on the title in question.
Yeah, what would you say led up to this film, and then what would you say directly comes after?
Well, leading up to it is a little harder to determine, but I'd say in terms of what came after, I would mention Altered States, Cloud Atlas. I'd be shocked if this wasn't on Jonathan Glazer's mind when he was making Under the Skin, if I'm being honest. Although, this next example isn't really from a film, it's a book. Philip K. Dick's Valis. There's a subplot in that novel about a character who becomes obsessed with this movie.
I mean, I would say I saw a few kind of 2001 nods in terms of the production design. Specifically, the final, like, bedroom sequence of 2001. Like, the white walls, white floors, and, like, the Baroque, kind of Rococo style furniture, especially in his final estate in this film.
And I think this expands upon that by merging that with a little more Art Deco techniques. The architecture in this movie is really something. And I think when we lament about lacking production design now, a lot of it really is just a matter of what locations you're willing to shoot in, what's there in front of the frame surrounding everyone, instead of just spaces tend to feel emptier now. Right now, in a way that kind of works against what you're looking at. It doesn't really give the image texture. It doesn't really suggest a broader life being lived beyond the margins. This, even if it is a little bit decadent about it, I'd say there is definitely a hint of a broader world here in a lost time of sorts, while also feeling like it's in between times. A movie where its head is all over the place, but still comes out as this conscious stream. It all feeds into each other. It's a weird, satisfying case of synchronicity for me.
For sure. And I see how You would get that. I would need to give it a few more views to really solidify that view. But the production design in his final house alone, his final estate, is just so wild. I was kind of baffled by that. Like there's the ping pong room with the like autumn leaves wallpaper, or like the autumn forest wallpaper, and then like the entrance into that house is just like dilapidated industrial space leading into like a refined, you know, there are so many different phases of it. I think that's so fascinating and really creative. And it came together as a fascinating sequence of like, this is what he's living now, storytelling through production design.
It covers a lot of ground in a fair, right? Again, the book moves pretty fast. Like it covers years within individual chapter. In chapters, you get that similar sense of displacement here, but in a way that's a lot, and again, subtle but not really, right?
Yeah,
if that makes any sense. By the way, if I hadn't mentioned earlier, I really love the commentary track for this movie. Buck Henry really comes off as very well spoken and literate. If we could ever devote an episode to him, I'd be happy to do it. We're gonna do it. He's a fascinating guy.
Yeah, I'll have to give it a listen and give him some research. Any final thoughts? Any closing things you want to touch on?
I want to add that it's back on the Criterion Channel. If you haven't seen it, go do so. Oh, I hope we sold you on it well
for sure
enough. But really, just check out any Nick Rogue film or in a film, because I'm certain we're going to cover another of his films in future. Or in the future, he is a filmmaker who I very much think is worth talking about, and definitely a filmmaker worth remembering now that he's been passed away. What, 5 years ago? 6 years ago now?
Something like that.
He connects to something true about the human condition for me, and it's in a various things. It's a mystery, it's a sadness, it's a momentary triumph. Right, it's all a memory piece.
That's right to hear.
I guess that's the way I'd sum it up. Chandler, have you seen anything else recently?
Nothing super recently that I felt was tremendously memorable. In a positive way, I'll say. I don't want to come on here and hate on movies.
I'm just picturing a soundboard at the base of my keyboard with things like garbage on them, like we're some hack like ringtone radio.
I don't want to be like that.
Show. Like before they launch into fucking Journey or whatever.
I saw one thing recently, and if you follow me on Letterboxd, you can see it, but one thing recently that was very long, and I've been thinking a lot about it, but in a sense of the idea that it's easier in a more immediate sense to learn from bad movies than it is to learn from good movies. Let me tell you, I learned a lot from that movie. It was rough. It was real rough, but in a fascinating way. That I would love to see what you think about it, Jack, but I don't want to recommend it to you. I don't want to put you through that.
Did the same director happen to do a film involving a man dressed as a bird?
Correct, yes.
Or a certain high-ranking, well-respected movie star in relations to a bear?
Correct, yep. You know the one.
Then I shall speak no further.
Okay.
Let's keep the mystery going. I like toying with people and not mystery. I mean,
it stuck with me and like pissed me off. In a way that I have a lot to say about it, and I could talk about it for a while, but there's something that was still successful in the fact that it did make me feel something, whether that be pissed off or not. And it like had some ideas that I love and like great use of symbols, but if for no reason or no purpose, and so that made it a horrible use of symbols in my opinion. And straight up ripped off some movies like Tree of Life, which is one of my favorites, specifically with the like finale sequence. And I don't know, that's whenever you asked me what I'd seen recently, anything stuck out, definitely that. But in a way, I gotta work through. I gotta watch some more movies to get over it.
Whenever you take a while to answer that question, I just imagine you, like, looking into a dark corner of the room, like, frightened with this, like, lynching drone in the background. Like, I mean, and by the way, dark corner, I mean, like, the rest of the room is perfectly illuminated, but that one corner is, like, pitch black, and there's eyes peeking through it. It steps out, and it's the poster for something like, oh,
yeah, that's what I was, was the first thing that came to my mind. I was like, should I talk about this? I don't want to use the title. I don't want to be a hater, but,
Yeah,
fascinating film.
I had a similar experience with an upcoming release that I'll tell
you about. I think I know which one you're talking about. You sent me the Letterboxd review. Is it that one?
Yeah, it's that one.
Okay, yeah. I want to see that one too. This is funny. It's just talking in code about movies.
I mean, it's definitely worth seeing, and if you can get the IMAX ticket, definitely go for it, but this is a really weird spot for an artist I particularly respect, and I think we will cover in future at some point.
I would love to cover that that film. And I love most of his other films.
I'm going
to
be honest, I was thinking a whole retrospective.
Cool.
We'll find a place for that in the schedule, but for now, if you don't follow us on Twitter already, we're at Warp Celluloid. You can find our past episodes on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. And you can follow me and Chandler on Letterboxd, and the link's in the description. Until then, okay, no more delays. We are going to do the Waking Life episode next time. Trust us, it'll be worth it. We hope. You see, there's that doubt sinking in. At the end. But seriously, y'all, thank you for listening. This show is always a fun time to do, and I always love it when Chandler can introduce me to new stuff, and I'm very excited to introduce him.
Absolutely, that's what it's all about. Thanks for listening.
But this next case I find interesting because it's one we kind of simultaneously discovered it in like slightly different points. I think you saw it like a little bit before or after I did, but I'm really curious what to know what living with that movie for a while and really processing it is going to bring to the table. I'm looking forward to the discussion.
But yeah, I'm excited to rewatch it, and I'm excited to rewatch this one too in the near future.
Till then, peace.